Well, grace and peace to each of you as we gather today. I'm just wondering if because the sun shines out there that everybody's out enjoying a little bit of fresh air and sunshine. We don't live in Washington State, so it was nice to see the sun come back. So welcome, and it's a pleasure to welcome Todd Winward among us. He is an author, educator, small-scale farmer, wilderness trip leader, and Mennonite minister for Watershed Discipleship, affiliated with Albuquerque Mennonite Church. That's a lot. He has been engaged in education reform and social change movements for 20 years and has spent more than 1,000 nights outdoors. Such fun. He and his wife, Peg, founded a wilderness-based public chartered school in 2001 and are now creating TILT, an incubator for intentional living in Taos, New Mexico. Now, TILT, if you looked online, is a Mennonite-inspired social change movement brewing around Taos, New Mexico. Loosely affiliated individuals in our community combine creative cultural resistance, transformative economics, watershed disciple, high desert homesteading, innovated education, and shared community practices to reimagine the good life in America, starting with our own. We seek to walk a wilder and simpler way at the crossroads of nature and scripture. So we will be hearing some of that today. And I trust that our awareness will be opened and we will be engaged by what Todd has to share with us. I invite you just to simply close your eyes as I read the two scriptures in your bulletin this morning. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty in any and all circumstances. I have learned the secret of being well-fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and of being in need. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. You are all we have. You give us what we need. Our lives are in your hands, O Lord. Our lives are in your hands.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for coming on this beautiful day. I have had the wonderful privilege of speaking 16 times in 6 days in Harrisonburg, and my last talk was with second graders yesterday. Before that was 350 high schoolers at Eastern Mennonite High School. And the night before that was with folks who were engaged in creation care across the Harrisonburg region. So it was a meeting of three different churches plus extra folks, just maybe 14 people, but highly engaged and interested in watershed discipleship and what that might mean in a 10-year life change covenant as we move toward the 500th anniversary of Anabaptism in 2025. And what kind of a transformative life way might we be showing in today's world as Anabaptists? So it's been a very heady, fun, engaging time. And I'm glad I have a book that I can rely upon to pull out a quick sermon. I didn't know what at all to do with the second and third graders. because I didn't feel like the themes in my book were something that they could grasp or that they wanted to grasp when we're looking at the plight of environmental and economic crisis that we're in and what we might do as consumers and petroleum addicts to change our way of life. That's not really where they are. That's not really their cup of tea. But I did have a piece about how Jesus did not have the Bible to use as his reference for life, but rather had some scrolls and a deep tradition, but used nature in all types of ways to teach eternal truths to from God to people. And so I luckily had a page where I have listed 38 different ways that Jesus looks at nature to find truth. And then we ask the kids to go out into their play area and their wild spaces and their gardens to see if there was something in nature that they could bring back to share with the other folks, and maybe it even had a meaning. And second and third graders don't always get the deepest metaphors at that point and don't know what that word means. But there were a lot of folks that brought back pine cones and talked about how the different shingles stuck together made a much stronger community, and how that reminded them of their school or their family or their church. Or there was the piece of squash that, you know, the squash has such big product and big leaves and then has these little funny tendrils that are like not really stable at all, but somehow they hold together. And one kid was showing how hard it was to pull these little fragile things apart. And if we stay together as little beings, we might weather a storm. So watershed discipleship is a lot about community resilience and what happens in the storm, what happens when there are economic tough times, what happens when we run out of fossil fuels, what happens when a shipment doesn't come. Like in Taos, the coldest winter we've experienced, there was a truck of natural gas pipeline that didn't come. And for 4 days, we had no gas. You can imagine that then people who are used to heating their homes with gas would plug in a space heater, so then the electricity spiked. And luckily, it didn't crash. But in the middle of this kind of crazy little taste of what it could be like if our systems broke down, as you might guess, incredible neighborliness, incredible miraculous gifting, firewood splitting, coming to check on the elderly. And so we often find paradise out of hell. And that's a book that a woman, Rebecca Slotnick, wrote that moves me a lot. But it's the kind of thing that we're looking at. We're looking at a pretty deep environmental and economic storm very likely coming. And what can we as Mennonites, what can we as people of faith, what can we as Jesus followers do? We use the term watershed discipleship that was coined by Ched Myers, who some of you may know from Southern California, and Bartimaeus Cooperative. He's a genius at developing names for things that intrigue me, like Sabbath economics. Like, what does that even mean? Watershed discipleship is something that brings an ecological, scientific, data-driven concept with a spiritual, Christian life change movement. And so it's something I've become a minister of, watershed discipleship. I think I am the only Mennonite minister of watershed discipleship in the world. Ooh. So, the Mountain States were kind enough, wise enough, foolish enough to give me that title and embrace what my wife and I were doing in Taos in the high desert. There was a combination of sort of high desert homesteading, innovative public school education, social reform, working with Hispanic and Pueblo traditions, working across boundaries to look at environmental causes, going deep into prayer and a 12-step addictive framework as we look at our own focus on petroleum and consumption. And we tried 5 years of living in a yurt, which was a wonderful experience. I don't mean try, like we lived for 5 years in a yurt, which is like a Mongolian tent. And this is, you know, it's negative 20 outside, snow 2 feet deep, and we have it 58, 60 degrees inside in the winter with wood-burning stove, and we carry our water from another house to that place, and we did that with our teenage son. Well, he was only 10 to 13 at that point. And we were also driving a Prius and had a cappuccino maker and had cell phones and were addicted to Netflix and loved all those things. So we're in this halfway place. We're in this transition place. So out of my own helplessness, I still am engaging with middle class activity and trying to change social structures and trying to have a mortgage and start a school and be professional and bathe somewhat regularly and all those things. And yet I'm still trying to live like a radical disciple of Jesus as best I can. And that may speak to your heart as well. I hope it does. Because we're caught in this kind of structure and most of us want to get out at some level. So I hope my book can speak to that. I hope you might find it of interest. I'm going to talk about a character trait that I think is vital for us to relearn from our scriptures. And I think the middle class and the unconscious sleeping Christian masses are destined to wake up. And when we wake up, we're going to be late for the party, but we have a heart for God. And when we get that this creation is sacred and we need to live with it in a different way, we're just going to become this vessel for the Spirit is my hope and prayer. And so this several character traits are needed in today's world as we transition across an Exodus kind of time and into a promised land that may hopefully be the very place we started, but living in a different way. So I write about trying to cultivate a divine insecurity, to try to rest upon something other than your possessions or your prowess or your prestige, but rather to be secure in God. And a restlessness that's natural to be questioning the dominant culture. And an inner authority of trusting yourself and what you know to be God's will as opposed to what the dominant culture is telling you about which car to buy or what career path to take. And one of these that moves me deeply is Paul and these mysterious two passages that I selected today. That have to do more with being content and the secret of being content. And one of the things that I thought was really fascinating, one of my greatest teachers that I keep sticking with right now is a little kid at a potluck who I was trying to make friends and bumping in, you know, you have potlucks, you don't really know a lot of people sometimes if it's at a new place. And I sat down with the kids' table trying to make some friends and didn't want to deal with the adults that I didn't know. And I said, hey, what's your favorite food? And this kid's just like, what's on my plate? You mean spaghetti? And he just drifted off. What's my favorite food? What's on my plate? What is available to me right now? Not what I wish was on my plate, not some other food that I abstractly remember from the last time I ate it. He was just a Zen guru Buddhist master to me. Whatever is on my plate is the thing that I will say is my favorite because it's here, now, ready, and available. And that's a little bit of changing my taste buds and my belief about what is my favorite thing. That as an American, I think I should be able to, for some odd reason, buy what I want, when I want, wherever I want, and throw it away however I want, and move on to the next thing because I'm American. And that's not Christian. And so I come back to Paul's words. And as an experiential educator, I want you to look at these words again, imagining that you are an experiential educator that has lived, been in the outdoors 1,000 days, and how you might read this. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being well-fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and of being in need. To learn the secret is an experiential rite of passage, is a change through wisdom. He didn't say, I read the book. He learned the secret of being content, whether in times of surplus or in scarcity. My immediate question, and I just need to preface by saying, I come to biblical scholarship through being in the outdoors and through being a writer who imagines another reality, not through scholarship, not through academic training. And so I know I may be knocking up against some established ways of thinking here, and I speak totally out of my own humility in feeling like I have been drawn to the text and tried to plumb the depths of it just out of my own heart, not in a way that is accurate, perhaps. but it is imaginative, and it is based on my own experience. And so I do ask for deep forgiveness if what I'm saying is something that doesn't jive with you in the way that you've learned something, but it's something that I've learned in my own experiential path. But I'm fascinated what Paul says here when he says, I have learned the secrets. This is the same language in Greek for what the mystery rites, the Gnostic folks at the time, used that same term of learning the secrets of entering into rites of passage and entering into ways of knowing that are experiential. And so my thought about this was, how did Paul learn this? What did he undergo? Another thing I uncovered, as many of you probably already know, but seems like one of the best-kept secrets, is that Paul, in his own narrative, has a very different experience after the Damascus Road. It's not what Luke says. Luke has a story of Paul coming back to the city very quickly. Paul, in his own narrative, just briefly mentions that, oh, by the way, I was gone for 3 years into Arabia. What does that mean? What happened during these 3 years? Was he in the wilds of Arabia? The term Arabia is very loose. Did he mean Mount Sinai, where his spiritual fathers went to confront God in the wilderness? Paul most likely was having a radical shock from thinking that he knew what God wanted as a Christian persecuting Jew, and suddenly was flat on his back with a brand new reality of a risen Lord. I doubt if he immediately got up and knew what to say. If he's like anyone that I know, he probably had to figure this out, and you do that through fear and trembling and experience. And he may have gone back out into the wilds in order to come back then to be able to be a wild man for God in culture. And so this notion of being okay or being content is an act of radical enoughness. And so this idea of accepting and embracing enoughness is a path that I've found that happens in the backcountry. When you're backpacking, or if you go on a cross-cultural experience anywhere, or if you leave your house for a little while, you're limited. And in our culture that loves unlimited access to everything all the time, to rewild yourself is to move into a place that has limitations. And when I walk in the backcountry with students or with a group of adults, these 12 people I'm with are my friends. I can't like or Facebook someone somewhere when I don't have that reception. I can't pretend that I'm with other people for very long. It gets kind of boring to have imaginary friends that way. This is my community, these 12 people. What kind of food do we have? Whatever we brought or whatever we can find. Is that going to be enough? It has to be. I can't go shopping or click something and make it come. And so when I think about what the Israelites were dealing with in the desert, and whatever manna was, it was enough. And whenever they tried to pack extra for the next day, it spoiled. How is that not an object lesson for us today? As we travel forward, can we have acceptance of enoughness? Can we say, what my watershed can provide in this region, I need to learn how to have it be not only enough, but blessed. I need to say thank you in a reciprocal, reverential way to the corn that comes up, to the potatoes that grow down, and say thank you, that will be enough for me. And I have to learn how to be an agent with the other agents in my biotic human and non-human community to create enoughness. And that might be enough culture, enough friendship, enough time, enough resources. And so the watershed discipleship movement is about creating resilience within your finite. We use a watershed because it's a good container for what you might need to care about. So thinking of watershed as parish, thinking about enoughness in your community for all, is a very planted, replaced way of walking the way of Jesus, and then of learning to treat your watershed as rabbi, like a region as rabbi too, that it can teach you things. So Ched started this movement, and I'm kind of running with it. And it's very exciting to be part of Mennonite Creation Care Network right now, which has been kind of a, frankly, a dusty museum of website options that one might choose sometime somewhere, but most people feel really disconnected from it who are part of that. However, recently, there's been a new interest and movement to think of a more activist strand within the network, and I'm proposing that we call this the Watershed Way, or Watershed Discipleship Harrisonburg, Watershed Discipleship Taos. And this idea of a 10-year life covenant is something I'll be talking about tonight at Common Grounds down the hill here at 9 o'clock. And it'll be both university students and activists in the community and just well-meaning Mennonites who don't really know what's going on yet but are interested in creation care. If you'd like to join us, we're going to try to create a network with the Mountain States and New Mexico being a hub. And Harrisonburg, frankly, is the first place that I'm unveiling this as an ambassador of Creation Care Network, that it may be that you all want to engage in this kind of a life change with us and see what happens over the next 10 years. So Paul himself, this term autarkeia, excuse me, when am I supposed to end? Excellent. Autarkeia, Paul claims, is not self-powered, but is God-powered. And he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me soon after. And so he separates himself from the philosophical Stoics of the time. This idea of autarkeia, of what he calls, what I would call adaptive self-reliance. That what if he's in a wealthy banquet? That would be a time of surplus. He's okay. He's chill with that. What about when he doesn't have so much? He's learned to be chill with that. He tells his friend Timothy, if we have food and we have clothing, we can be content with that. So it's a model that he is teaching. You might imagine, too, that Paul, I actually did a little study of watching how far he traveled and what he did. He traveled thousands and thousands of miles, some on ships, a lot on land, and it would be a little teeny sentence in the Bible. You look in the New Testament, he goes, and then I went from here to here, and you look at that and like, that's 400 miles. Like, you know, it's he traveled distances, obviously, as a tent maker. I'm guessing he probably used a tent. He probably didn't stop in 4-star hotels. He was probably rambling on foot, living on the top of the deck of a small boat. He was hardcore, and he learned to be totally fine, and he taught his people to be totally fine, whether in times of surplus or of scarcity. And can we, as we weather the storms, as we think about retirement, as we think about moving up in the world, can we bring that radical stance of adaptive self-reliance into wherever we go? I think we need to, if we're going to be relevant to the next few years, if we're going to be relevant to the next few decades, we need to be evangelism at its best. And there's nothing better to me than having a countercultural, earth-honoring, Jesus-loving, despair-erasing, community-rich culture that says we're cool with this. We can move forward. We have a sense of calm because God is indeed with us. We have a 4,000, 6,000-year tradition. Don't you want to join us? That's amazingly attractive to someone who's worried, fragile, nervous. What's going to happen? Am I going to have enough? And if we can embody that authority, that means we become mentors into a spiritual process. And this idea of enoughness, God has always wanted us to be okay with enoughness. And you look at that strand back through time, back to the very earliest. What about that apple? I know I have everything else, but can't I just grab something else? I wonder if the original sin is needing more than what we have. And then you look at Moses and his ability to try to figure out what was happening and try to take his people through, and only Caleb of the appreciative spirit was one of the old guard who actually made it to the promised land. The other folks were born in the desert. They were the young folks who lived with enoughness from day one. They were the ones who could inherit the promised land. The meek inheriting the earth, the anav, as it's called in Hebrew, the humble being able to inherit the earth on its own terms. It feels like enoughness is this grand theme. And when you look at the anti-civilization narratives in Old Testament and New of people intentionally living in tents outside of the city instead of moving in, Pharaoh, when he's talking to Moses and saying, the first time when Pharaoh and Moses are negotiating, they don't immediately say no. He says, you can come and worship your God within the precincts of our domain. And Moses is blunt. That would not be right. Our God needs to be worshipped in the wild. There's a sense of enoughness of the festival of booths, this idea of that we know of from Old Testament of coming out to the harvest and having a tent city at the harvest. People were definitely living on what they could have at the time, enjoying abundance, understanding scarcity. And this is something we've completely lost as a culture. And it's so exciting that there's movements happening, both secular and religious, about this. And so I think about John Muir and John D. Rockefeller. John Muir and John D. Rockefeller, legendarily, supposedly, the big difference between John D. Rockefeller and John Muir, John Muir said, the difference between the two of us is he doesn't have enough. John D. Rockefeller was, of course, a railroad tycoon who was the wealthiest man in the world. And John Muir joked to say that it was John D. Rockefeller who didn't have enough because his appetite was insatiable. That, unfortunately, is a lot of us, a lot of America. And even us Mennonites who like thinking that we're a little bit down below those people, we care a whole lot about our holdings and our IRAs and our protection and what Everence is doing for us or not doing for us. And I would just ask us to think about how we can turn personal wealth into commonwealth and how we can think about living lower on the totem pole, living closer to the land, thinking about enoughness in our own lives. Thank you. I pray that that may so.